morning, everyone. I'm going to be talking about, again, a 14, just like Alan, had a 14-year study, only this time it's out at Washington State. In Washington State, I'd like to recognize a couple of my co-authors. There's been several people involved in this project since its inception, but Ann Kennedy, soil microbiologist with ARS, and Tim Politz, a plant pathologist with ARS. It all started back in 1997 when this fellow, Ron Jaray, announced to the world that in this huge wheat fallow region that he was not going to practice wheat fallow anymore, but he was going to start annual cropping, and he was going to put his whole farm into that. And he would like some research done, so we just sort of grabbed onto his shirt tails and took it from there. Here are the basic objectives of it. We want to test the annual, this is, by the way, it's a tillage-based wheat fallow system out there. 95% of it's tillage, one crop every 2 years, tillage-based. So test the annual no-till and conservation till rotations as an alternative to this just two-year rotation. We've had a lot of crops involved through the years. We're now in our fourth phase, but they've involved winter wheat, winter triticale, spring pea, spring barley, yellow mustard, safflower, and winter pea, so quite diverse for eastern Washington. 20-acre site, 56 plots, big long strips, 500 feet long. Long-term precipitation is 11.5, but over the last 14 years, we've only averaged 10.2, and some of those years have been really dry. And we've had a number of people involved with this through the years, including some very talented graduate students. We talked no-till. Here are the two drills we used. One is a cross slot. Is there a pointer here, Bunny? No pointer. Okay.
You can use the mouse.
Oh, okay. Whoops, I'm making a mess of things. On the top left, that's a cross slot drill, a low disturbance disc drill, and on the bottom right is a hoe drill. Both of those the fellows in the shop made at the Dryland Research Station at Lind, where I'm based. So those have been our two drills that we've used. I'm just going to go through this real briefly. Again, we've had four phases. Pay attention. Oh, there it is. Okay. We've had a lot of different rotations. Most of them have not involved too much fallow. I'm going to be talking about these later because we've had these throughout the 14 years, which is continuous spring wheat and then spring wheat in rotation with barley. So I'll be talking about those a little bit more in detail. But the point I wanted to make here is that we've had some various phases of this experiment. The farmers have been involved in advisory capacity in all of these. And so we're trying to make our best possible advances with these types of things. Well, we got 3 years into this experiment, and all of a sudden these holes started showing up in the plots. And we were going, what in the heck is this? Well, it didn't take long for the plant pathologist, Tim Politz, to say that's Rhizoctonia bare patch disease, which is a fungal disease that is pretty unique to no-till. And it came in very severe in these plots. And so we actually looked at this as an opportunity to study this phenomenon in more detail. And here's basically what it does. Your seedlings will come up, and then they'll just, this fungal pathogen will just take over and kill it, and it kills it in round or elongated spots, and you don't get any crop yield there. And it affects every crop that we planted. Every crop that we planted at this site is affected by Rhizoctonia bare patch. And in addition, Jim Cook, who was involved with the project earlier, took a whole number of plants and exposed them to this inoculum, and they're all susceptible to Rhizoctonia root rot. This is a big disease in Australia. This is where it first came to the forefront, and then it came out to eastern Washington in this study. Here it is in another otherwise not very nice crop of spring barley. And again, you get zero yield from those obviously. Here it is in yellow mustard. I could show you it in safflower and every crop we've grown. But what we did beginning in 1999 is we said, well, you know, here, let's start mapping these spots. And so we've been GPSing these spots throughout the field for the last, since 1999, the last 11 years, with a GPS. And here you see a technician going around the spot, with the GPS. And the only thing that we found that grows in those spots is Russian thistle, which is the main weed, broadleaf weed, we have out in Washington State. And so even the Russian thistle doesn't like growing there, but it's such a resilient, tough weed. It'll put its taproot down and look real sickly. And then it gets into that water beneath there, and then it just flourishes. And before the Russian thistles come in, this is an island of water. Roots do not grow into this bare patch. And so you have islands of bare patch full of water that should grow a crop, but they're not because of these patches. And so, again, we've mapped these every year for the last years. And here's a year during when it was really severe, taking up 15% of our total crop area. Those red areas are Rhizoctonia bare patches where nothing was being produced. And here's the good news. This is the Rhizoctonia bare patch area averaged over all crops, no-till crops, not those that had a fallow. But this is all no-till crops grown in this entire experiment since 1999. And you can see it started increasing, and we got up here into the 2002, 2003, 2004, and we were averaging 11%, and just really peaking out with this Rhizoctonia root disease. And our Australian colleagues said, well, hold on long enough, and you should go into decline. There's a documented case in Australia where they grew continuous wheat for long enough, and the Rhizoctonia bare patch started to decline. That's the only other example in the world where this happened. And sure enough, we start getting over here into the 2005, 2006, and we saw some reduction, but we didn't know if that was going to be permanent, but then it just dropped off. And so for the last 3 years out in this experiment, we've had essentially no Rhizoctonia bare patch. So we have declined, and there's a bunch of reasons for it, and I don't have time to go into it, and I'm not the plant pathologist, but it's a natural suppression of Rhizoctonia bare patch that now we have the second case documented in the world, and the first in the U.S. For this phenomena, and the first with diverse no-till cropping. So this is a good news story. What has been the effect of bare patch? Remember I said that we had the continuous wheat and the continuous wheat, or the spring wheat in with the spring barley, the two-year rotation. Well, if we have a two-year rotation with spring barley, the wheat after that has less Rhizoctonia bare patch versus growing continuous spring wheat, as seen here. It hasn't been significant in all years. There's been considerable variability, but you average it over this 11-year period, and it's about double the amount of bare patch in continuous spring wheat versus spring wheat after spring barley, and that is a significant difference. If we take that over to grain yields, we see the same phenomena. Spring wheat after spring barley always yields a little bit more. And it's not significant every year, but in the long term, it's highly significant. So barley is a great rotation crop, and we do get a rotation benefit with it. And it also helped to suppress the Rhizoctonia bare patch during these years. Soil quality, Ann Kennedy has been monitoring this essentially every other year. She goes out and does a full workup. I'm just going to report on organic carbon here. This created quite a stir when we published this in 2007. Because what we said is after 8 years of no-till cropping in this winter wheat summer fallow zone, we went from, here's native soil here, which is a 1.5% organic carbon. After 130 years of wheat fallow farming, have reduced that to 1% or less. And here we saw that if we just grow, do annual no-till diverse cropping, whether it's continuous wheat or what have you, we reached a native carbon levels in just 8 years. And at the time, people said, well, that's probably a fluke. Well, it's really not a fluke because it's held up here since then, those high carbon levels. This is the barley. That's come down a little bit, and Ann Kennedy's got a bunch of reasons for that, too, that I don't have time to go into. But the take-home message here is we did increase the organic carbon quite rapidly out there in that wheat fallow region just by growing a crop every year with no-till. Here are the grain yields. I'm just going to show you what the winter wheat summer fallow versus continuous spring wheat. Again, the farmers, as Alan alluded to, the economics is the driver of this whole thing. The solid bar is winter wheat summer fallow, or is winter wheat after summer fallow. The striped bar is continuous spring wheat. These numbers that you see here, like 70 here, that means that year the spring wheat produced 70% of the winter wheat yield. Here the spring wheat produced 40% of the winter wheat yield. And this line here is the annual precipitation for that particular year. Well, if we look at it over a 14-year period, basically, continuous spring wheat has to produce 66% of the yield of winter wheat after fallow to be economically in the ballpark. We did that in 5 out of 14 years, as you can see here. So in 5 out of 14 years, it was economically viable to grow a spring crop versus taking it to fallow and growing winter wheat, which is not that good. And then if you look at over the 14 years, we only averaged 56%. So this is all tied, as you might imagine, to water. And so during the course of the last, my last 18 years, we've been looking at soil water and quite extensively at essentially every experiment we're involved with. And we've fit a relationship based on 175 replicated field trials over that time to give farmers a prediction method on when it might be a good time to plant spring wheat. And what we know is that for bushels per inch of available water, we're in a Mediterranean environment, of course, so we get most of our precip in the winter. So for every inch of water you can store in the soil, you'll basically get 5.4 bushels of wheat. And you can pretty much count on that. For any additional water you get in April, you don't get much in April because it's wet and the wheat's not growing much. You only get 1.4 bushel. But boy, if you can get an inch of rain in May or June, you know, those are worth 6.4 and 5.7 bushels. And so, and then you have to subtract 10.6 bushels off of this. It's a regression equation because, you know, that's for vegetative growth. But this is a really tight relationship. It really works quite well. And so the key, of course, the only thing a farmer can predict is this, or measure, is this overwater gain. So the take-home message we have for farmers is if you have 5 inches of stored available water in your soil, you have a really good, you have a pretty good chance of growing a spring crop. If you don't have that amount of water, you're going to have a higher risk, and you're going to have to rely on these May and June rains, which are highly variable. So anyway. That's basically what's going out. We do have several publications from this study. You can, if you're interested in getting reprints, just please contact me or look on the web. We have them on our website. Look up Lind Research Station, and we have all these publications there as well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If he's not here, then we'll ask you to continue.
Sure.
Yes, Silvano Abdu is here. Now Dan
will ask him
question for the next
15
minutes.
15
minutes, okay?
And maybe Alan could.
So that way, we can ask him question because we cannot take next speaker and talk. So we can continue for discussion. So please, any
yes.
Questions,
yeah? Yeah. The first question I had was on your organic carbon. You showed that over what 8-10 years they climbed up. What depth did they sample?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was 0 to 5 centimeters. First couple inches. There was no increase in the 2 to 4 inch, which is pretty common, I guess.
So, Bill, what's Ron doing now? What's he decided to do?
Good question. He has taken most of his farm back into the wheat fallow rotation, but he is using the ultimate conservation tillage method, which is a undercutter, which is a thin sweep blade. which slices through the soil to break capillary continuity. He puts his fertilizer down with that. He's retaining as much residue as he can, and he's still devoting a half section a year to annual cropping, including the 20 acres that we use on his farm.
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of questions. One is that what brought down the value of clothing after 9-10 years? It's almost zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, are the appearing spring wheat with winter wheat, just single crop in 2 years, like summer fallow and then winter wheat? Or it's two crops of winter wheat versus two crops of spring wheat?
Well, your first question was what brought down the Rhizoctonia root rot. I should have boned up on that. And Tim Paul, it's just a natural suppression. The soil, there's different soil microorganisms that come into play over the period of time that will suppress the fungal pathogens that are causing the Rhizoctonia root bare patch. And so the take-home message there is if you have this, we have two documented cases in the world now that it will decline. Why it showed up at this particular site in such a severe mode is not understood. We've known about Rhizoctonia root rot in the Pacific Northwest for a long time. These pathologists have never seen it expressed as severely as what I showed in the slides. So anyway, it's a natural suppression. Your second question was something to do with the cropping systems.
Yeah, with the winter wheat and spring wheat, when you compare, is it one crop versus one crop?
Oh, I'm sorry. The winter wheat was that winter wheat after summer fallow, so that's one crop every 2 years, versus continuous spring wheat, which was one of our treatments in the experiment.
So two crops of spring wheat versus one crop?
Yes, exactly. I'm sorry, the winter wheat? It was in, except for 5 out of 14 years. Yeah. Yeah, Michelle.
I was curious, you know, we have the same problem with prairie dogs out on the range in Colorado. You get a big peak of them, and then 7 year cycle, and they're done for a while. They play out. Do you think this might come back? This Rhizoctonia will come back, and they'll start having the disease again? Or?
It has not in Australia, in where they've used it. It's when it's suppressed, it stayed suppressed. So the thought is that it's done its thing.
If you have a question about Alan, you can also ask him.
Yeah.
Raised in Western North Dakota many, many years ago, so I'm familiar with spring wheat and farming operations. I have a question that relates to the economics of this business, because there are differences in prices of those wheats. They're not big, but there's also tillage maintenance going on here. So that farmer that chose to go over tells me that their economics works out to winter wheat fallow. Is that correct?
Yes, and I should mention that we've had a very talented economist involved with this project, Doug Young. He just recently retired. I actually probably should put him as a co-author on this paper. I've usually done that. This study has had a very systematic economic analysis. We've had two papers on this, just on the economics of these systems. And so it takes into all of those factors, the equipment costs, the variable costs. So that has been done. And winter wheat, summer fallow still comes out the winter, except in the wetter years. So how do we plant spring crops in those wetter years when we're relying on that May and spring rain? The only thing we can really count on is that overwinter storage.
And you'd be up against harvesting the winter wheat. You'd have to go fallow after that, right? Because you harvest the winter wheat in June, you plant the spring wheat in April, right?
Harvesting in late July and August, and planting our spring wheat in late March, early April. Yeah. Yeah. So that's where we can store water and get some kind of idea what kind of chance we'll have for our spring crop.
You have still 10 minutes. So
Alan, you need to get up here. Alan's question is, do we have a winter wheat, spring wheat rotation? No, but we had a winter wheat, spring wheat, spring barley, fallow rotation. I could go back to that slide and show you. Here are the rotations that we had through all those years, through all those phases. One thing that did not work was winter wheat after winter wheat. When we went into phase two, the farmers were interested in this one. Winter wheat after winter wheat, they said, we want to grow winter wheat. We want to grow as much winter wheat as we can. So we backed up winter wheat on winter wheat, and we had just an explosion of downy brome, cheatgrass. And where did this cheatgrass come from? Because before that, in this part of the rotation, where we had no winter crop, we had no cheatgrass. So that was one of the take-home messages, that this cheatgrass, this downy brome, can remain dormant for a long time. And once it gets an opportunity to come up with a second winter wheat crop, it can do it. So, are there any questions for Dr. Schlegel?
Yeah, Steven?
I have another comment for you. The Rhizoctonia decline is very analogous to the take-all decline.
Yes.
Back in the 70s,
yeah.
Where the disease over a period of about 10 years peaks and then declines off to essentially nothing. And then it does not really peak, it doesn't cycle back or anything like that. It stays in decline.
Yeah, excellent point, Stephen. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I had a question for you then. Since you showed very clearly that barley is very beneficial in the rotation, why are our barley acres declining so?
Yeah, good point. Steven's also from my university, and he knows the answer to this better than anybody, but barley has declined in the state of Washington, in the Pacific Northwest in general. We're down to less than 100,000 acres of barley in the state of Washington, which is sort of sad because it's a great rotation crop. It all comes down to the economics. Wheat pays better.
I saw, and since you are talking about, I mean, studies for a long time, and your control you compare with native soil.
Yes.
And I saw that it's native soil, the carbon content you have shown is almost flat.
Yes.
Yeah. So how does it? I mean, how you have managed the native soil so it can carbon all the way it was flat? Sometimes if it is not flat, then if it's coming down and you are increasing a little bit, then you can reach up to that and the control, and still we can say I think we are reaching up to the control. So how you have seen, did you measure like every time it was?
Yes, we measured that actually in county cemeteries. If you go around in every township, every 36 sections, they've established, and so they've set those up on deep soils for obvious reasons for burials. And so we would just back in there with our probes every couple years and take some samples. So that was our native soil, because otherwise all the other good soil has been being farmed.
So there were no, I mean, what the vegetation, what was the vegetation?
It's mostly just bunch grass. You know, perennial bunch grass and sagebrush. That's the native vegetation.
So it was more or less aesthetic.
Yeah, and it's remained stable. You know, it's about 1.5% organic matter. Mm-hmm.
Is there an interest in the peas and lentils for trying to grow continuous cropping with a more water efficient?
Yes, we have winter peas. I didn't show that. We have winter peas in these rotations. Up in the higher precip region, especially the Palouse region that you've probably heard of, peas is a very commonly grown. Lentils, chickpea, those are grown. The farmers like it. Very good rotation crops, and they do use less water. And after those crops, you can really grow a great winter wheat crop. Dryland winter wheat yields probably average about 100 bushel per acre in the Palouse, so farmers like those lentil rotations very much to set them up for winter wheat.
I just wanted to know, Bill, how deep was your sampling for your organic matter, your organic harvest? Did you go just the surface?
The sampling was 0 to 2 inches, 2 to 4, and 4 to 10. The carbon that I reported was just for the 0 to 2 inches from Ann's data. Any questions for Dr. Schlegel? Well, you know, in fairness.
Okay.
clocking him?
Yeah, well, let's see.
But I have one question. Question that is, so you use the native soil as a baseline carbon measurement
yes.
for the year. So cemetery, that means undisturbed, no deal, mm-hmm. and a lot of, we go there.
Mm-hmm.
So organic matter, isn't that organic matter or organic carbon should increase?
In the native soil?
Right.
No, it's in, at equilibrium. Keep in mind, this is really low precipitation region.
Saturated condition?
I never saturated. Again, it's an 11.5-inch rain annual precip zone. So I would assume that those organic carbon levels have been steady for the last, you know, 1,000 years.
And another question is, for winter peas, you harvested for yield?
Yes. The farmers are interested in winter peas. We put those out at our, I'm actually work at the Lind Research Station. So this site is 15 miles north. And you'd say, well, why don't you just put it at your research station? Well, this site where I'm doing 15 miles, we gain 2 inches of precipitation. And so it's, so the farmers, we put these winter peas out at our research station and showed them at a field day. And then these farmers, of course, are very smart. And they started figuring out all the nitrogen that was getting fixed and the cost of nitrogen. And so they're very interested in those, even though the cost, the price of peas right now itself is quite low. But, of course, that can change. So
we grow winter pea after harvesting wheat in Ohio. So then we have no-till corn without any nitrogen.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
That's
yeah, yeah. That's what we're doing with the wheat afterwards. With the peas, we're just no nitrogen, no at all. The question is, what kind of grain yields do we get on winter wheat and winter lentils? This region that I'm talking about, winter wheat after summer fallow will average 50 bushels per acre. We don't have enough experience on. We've never grown lentils out there. Peas, we can get safflower, we'll get 800 pounds per acre. We can do about the same for yellow mustard. Spring canola will do about the same. We don't have any experience with lentils, and we're just now getting into peas, but I would expect our pea yields will be about in that same range, you know, 500 to 600, 800 pounds per acre if we're lucky.
Any questions? Give you a big hand.